Okay. To start things off, I'd like you to meet Carol.
Let's see. I'm a woman of a certain age, and I was a midwife my whole life. Actually, I was the first midwife to be licensed to practice legally in New Hampshire.
Carol Leonard is an author who lives in rural Maine, close to Acadia National Park. And in what is the weirdest twist I've ever experienced while interviewing anybody, as I was talking to Carol, I learned this.
I may have, and you have to ask your mother this, but I may be the first woman to ever touch you, Sam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Turns out, Carol was midwife at my birth. I did some fact-checking, by the way, and learned it was, in fact, not Carol, but Carol's business partner, who was the first woman to touch me at delivery. But anyway, that's not why we got in touch with Carol. We reached out to her because of what happened once she was done being a midwife. When she retired, she and her husband decided to move to Maine.
We had the really good fortune in 2005 to find a great piece of land. It's 400 acres.
Near where her great-grandfather is buried. It was their dream property, and they set about building their dream home. But almost right away, they started to have trouble.
So we've got, I don't know, I would say at least 25 acres underwater, probably. Some of the flowage has got ominously close to where we, you know, you have to be 75 feet away from a wetlands in order to put in a septic system. And that was starting to be an issue.
As Carol and her husband settled into their dream property, they soon realized a family of beaver also had their beady little eyes on it. And they were set on building their dream home.
So we have these beavers that are genetic aberrations that they can actually, they're mason beavers. They can actually pile up rocks and then they grout them in, they mortar them in with clay. And so it looks like the Tower of London.
And those mason beavers wreaked some serious havoc. Their dams flooded about 25 acres of Carol's property, and one of the beaver ponds started to catch more and more water, creeping closer and closer to where Carol and her husband were hoping to build their house.
We have stone dams.
Yeah.
I'm serious. No, they're insane. These beavers are insane. They're very cute. I mean, I think they're adorable, but they're also, they're rodents.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. If you pick a fight with a beaver, here's what you've got to consider. We have got other stuff to do. Jobs, meals to cook, soccer games. Beavers, on the other hand, they do one thing, build dams. So we're starting off today's show by talking about trying to live with beavers, trying to trick beavers, and even whether to kill beavers. This is also a story about how, with respect to beavers, we may have backed ourselves into a trap and almost guaranteed our two species will come into conflict. Before we get into cohabitating with beavers, there are a few things you need to understand about them. First, beavers are hardwired to stop water to a crazy degree. They have what's called a damming instinct. It's activated by running water, and it is strong. In one famous experiment, beavers were put in a dry concrete room with a speaker that played the sound of running water. Just the sound, no water. The beavers built a dam right over the speaker. They build these dams so that they can store sticks at the bottom of their ponds. That way, when winter comes and everything freezes, they've still got a stash of tasty, tender twigs that they can access safely all winter long. Also, beavers on land are tasty morsels for predators, whereas beavers in water are really hard to chase, so more water means more safe spaces for them. If you've never seen a proper, massive beaver dam before, you need to get yourself onto the internet right now and look at some. The biggest one in the world is about half a mile long and 13 feet tall. It was identified from outer space. When I was researching this story, a beaver enthusiast sent me a photo of a beaver dam that had been built right through the cab of an old pickup truck. Beavers' teeth grow constantly, and they actually have to keep chewing wood to keep them in check. And yes, they do actually just eat wood. They eat the cambium, the soft, spongy layer of new growth that's just under the bark. I'd love to play for you some beaver sounds here, but they don't make many. The thing you're most likely to hear is when they slap the water with their tails if you freak them out. On the ecological side, beavers do all sorts of great things. Beaver ponds help to ease flooding downstream. They slow water down as it rushes towards the ocean, meaning they help to recharge drinking water aquifers. Their ponds support large numbers of bird species, fish, amphibians, otters. They're what's called a keystone species, the keystone to a whole ecosystem. And they've been kicking around North America for 7 or 8 million years. What's new, on the millennial timescale, are Europeans. Europeans with an admiration for a specific part of the beaver.
We know that London, on average, received 70,000 beaver pelts a year.
This is Ann Carlos, economic historian from the University of Colorado Boulder, and who studies the fur trade of the 17 and 1800s.
And the French trade, they were bringing in about 166,000 pelts a year.
When the Europeans arrived in the U.S., first went the fur trappers and fur traders, driven by intense demand for top hats, made from felt, made from beaver fur. Because nothing says class like putting the world's second largest rodent on your noggin. After the fur traders came the farmers. Farmers with an admiration for a byproduct of the beaver.
Beaver were going to be both a source of cash for these settlers, and of course a problem for the settlers because beaver are competing for the same environment.
Beaver ponds, once the dams are destroyed and the water drained, turn into something called beaver meadows, which, as it turns out, are fantastic places to grow crops. So in the early 1800s, farmers started to create these fertile beaver meadows by force. They trapped any remaining beavers on their property, destroyed the dams, drained the ponds, and voila, a field was born. All these pressures were bad news for beavers.
And by about 1830, I think many of these populations were being seriously over-harvested and run down.
One study found that 16 states lost more than 50% of their wetlands as settlers rolled in. Another 6 states, mostly in the Midwest, lost more than 85%. By the 1890s, while in Canada they came through okay, all throughout the northeast of the U.S., the beaver were virtually wiped out. Meanwhile, year after year, we're building. Those farms built on old beaver ponds are connected together by roads. More of the fields are subdivided and turned into housing developments. Bit by bit, we begin to occupy the space the beavers once held. And then in the early 1900s, we brought the beaver back. Why? Because for one, biologists had begun to recognize how good they are for ecosystems. But also, people liked having them around so they could trap them. We reintroduced them and helped them to build back up again until they numbered in the millions. We had set a trap for ourselves.
Our roads were based on Native American trails, a high number of them.
This is Pat Tate. He's the beaver biologist for Fish and Game here in New Hampshire.
And a high number of those Native American trails were based on game trails.
He took me on a tour of his hometown, Hudson, and he's explaining why so much of our infrastructure is in a bad spot when it comes to conflicts with beavers.
I can't say as a hunter who has walked all over the state of New Hampshire, their preferred wetland crossing every time has been a beaver dam. So,
in other words, our roads and bridges, wherever they cross wetlands, very frequently, they're on top of natural pinch points, places where animals used to like to walk, Native Americans used to follow them, and beavers used to like to build dams.
So all our roads are built in spots that are like prime targets for beavers, basically.
Our high number of our wetland crossings are prime spots where beavers would have naturally chose to build their dam. Yep.
And then if what we do is we build a road and then put a tiny hole through it for the water to drain through, it's basically like we've done most of the work for them.
Correct.
Let me make this progression really simple. We eliminated the beaver. We filled in maybe 50% of their ponds, or more in some places. We built our society on top, and then we brought them back. Is it any wonder that they keep flooding our roads and our septic systems? And when they do, is it any wonder that our first response is to get rid of them? And to be clear, when I say get rid of them, I mean trapping them. And when I say trapping them, I mean kill them. But Pat actually argues that, in fact, trapping some beaver is actually something you should feel good about. This is because of a concept called carrying capacity. It's the point at which
as many animals that are born that year, that many animals die that year.
So zero population growth. Why? Because as the numbers rise, more beavers starve to death, or catch respiratory infections, or get eaten by weasels. More die. Carrying capacity is the number of animals the land can sustain.
Disease, predation, and what's called intra-specific competition. Intra-specific competition is like sibling fights, only their sibling fights are fights to the death.
Yeah, beavers, watch out.
I've went into areas where people have been trapped for a number of years and started removing animals and noticed that they are very bit up. And that's how beavers fight, they bite each other. And I once removed a beaver that had a beaver tooth in its back, and it didn't grow its own tooth in its back. That was a tooth from another beaver that somehow broke off in the animal's back. As I've reduced numbers in the wetlands and went back subsequent years to trap, the amount of scarring and bite marks on the beaver decreases. So the individual beaver's health increases.
So the argument is that by taking some of them, you're making life better for the ones who remain.
Yeah, you absolutely are. By removing individuals from a wetland system, it's making more food available for the ones left behind. And they don't have to fight over resources or space or things like that because there's enough there.
Do you think that this is at all like a scary metaphor for humans?
You know, humans and global domination.
I won't make you comment on that.
No, I know what you're saying. It gets very odd to think about.
You've heard this logic. You have to cull the herd. You have to thin the population for the individuals to thrive. This is called the American system of wildlife management. Instead of dealing with a troublesome animal every time one floods a septic tank, we decide how big of a population of a species we want and then make adjustments based on that decision. Are deer eating the shoots off of too many saplings out in the forest? Increase the number of deer hunting permits issued. Are farmers complaining about losing livestock to coyotes? Relax hunting limitations on them. Are there so many beaver that they're expanding wetlands until they flood wells and roads? Call in trappers to reduce beaver populations in that location.
Ow. Done.
If you've never seen one, the most common trap used to kill beaver is like a big rectangular spring. It's typically placed underwater in a place where beaver will swim through the middle of the square and hit a trigger, which brings down two stiff bars that catch the beaver right on the neck.
We're working with a glorified mouse trap.
Jeff Trainer's a trapper from southern New Hampshire, and he took us out on a cold winter day, walked us over the top of a beaver lodge.
You don't want to spook them or make them nervous too much.
Do you ever hear them in there? Can
yep.
you ever hear them?
Yeah. They do these little, it's almost like a wink, 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 wink.
He found a spot he thought would work, and chopped through the ice, and set up the trap.
Once I remove these safeties.
There are still people who trap beaver in order to eat them to survive. Think First Nations in northern Canada. But there aren't many of them anymore. And while trappers do often sell the fur of the beaver they catch, a pelt doesn't go for very much these days. Most people who trap aren't doing it because they have to, or because that's how they make a living. They do it because they want to. They want to connect with a tradition that they identify with, Or maybe they just like getting outside and doing the close observation of nature that trapping requires. And Jeff hears a lot of hypocrisy when he hears people call trapping immoral. He notes that you don't see the same outrage at housing developments or highways or parking lots, the forces that he sees really limiting the population of beaver.
Our population isn't slowing down anytime soon. And we, let's face it, we are the most invasive species on the planet. There's no doubt about it. And as we encroach more, we're pushing them more and more and more. So where is that overflow going? There's only so many places that they can go. It comes to a point where you can say, well, let nature take its course. Or you can say, you know, as human beings, can we manage this creature with moral wisdom?
Moral wisdom. Make life better for some beavers by killing some others. This argument does not hold water for the most devoted beaver believers.
You know, you always hear, okay, we have to kill the beavers so they don't get hungry. And if you're an individual beaver, you can imagine which choice they would choose if they had one to make, right? Would you rather be hungry or dead?
This is Skip Lyle, founder of Beaver Deceivers International. He has spent decades designing devices that, through strategically placed pipes, fences, and grates, gently redirect beavers away from human habitats. These are solutions that people are trying. People like Art Walensky.
The whole situation is unusual. We have two ponds, actually, an upper pond and a lower pond.
He's retired and lives in a little development in New Hampshire with other retired folks. Out behind the houses are two big old beaver ponds, separated by a little access road.
And there are four large culvert pipes that go underneath the road.
And running alongside that access road is a big old beaver dam.
It goes up just about 300 feet. You can see all the way up to the turn there where that evergreen is.
One of the ponds drains under the road to the other pond, and the beavers started to dam up the pipes, which led to even more flooding. That flooding could have led the roadbed to fail, and underneath this particular road was the sewer line for all of the houses here. So, if the beavers win, there goes the neighborhood.
What we put in was what's called the beaver deceiver.
A few years later, Art also put in something called a pond leveler, aka a beaver pipe or flow device.
It's a large 24-inch diameter, no, I'm sorry, 19-inch diameter? Well, that's
a big pipe.
it's a big flexible pipe.
It goes right through the dam and basically tricks the beaver into thinking the dam's working when it isn't. To round out his defenses, Art also wraps the bases of any trees that he wants to save with a wire mesh that beavers can't chew their way through. So, this is what people who oppose trapping say we should be doing instead. Use tricks to limit where and how much habitat the beavers can make. That way, when the little beaver babies grow up and start their own little beaver family, they won't be able to just make this pond bigger and move over to the other side. They'll have to go elsewhere. That means instead of coming into conflict with Art, they'll come into conflict with things that normally keep beaver populations in check, like predators or other beaver, or maybe they'll just wind up in someone else's backyard. But the point is, according to folks like Skip Lyle, beavers don't need us.
Beavers are a 2-million-year-old species, right? By some miracle, they survived just fine. They suffered, they died, they thrived, but they did it on their own, like most species do. You know, we don't manage chickadees, you know, to make sure that, you know, some chickadees aren't hungry sometimes.
Skip argues that less trapping would mean more beavers, more wetlands, more water in the aquifers, more birds and other wildlife. Oftentimes, the decision to cull wildlife is based on ecosystem science. Government biologists go out to try to estimate how many animals the land can sustain. That, again, is the carrying capacity. But sometimes, this decision is based on our willingness to tolerate animals. This, almost euphemistically, we call the cultural carrying capacity. And for beavers, it's often that cultural limit not the actual limits of the habitat that they bump up against. For the beavers on Art Walensky's property, they're bumping up against someone who's a member of Voices for Wildlife, an animal welfare advocacy group.
I mean, I was raised on a farm. I used to hunt and I used to trap. I would never do it now because back in those days, and probably again, if you look at most of the trappers who are my age or even younger, were raised in a time when people thought that animals had no feelings, animals didn't think, animals weren't rational. Well, we know that's not the case now. So that we know they feel that pain, we know they feel that loss and so on.
So, if we did what Art wants and banned trapping, what would happen? Turns out, we have some idea.
So in 1996, there was a ballot referendum in Massachusetts that was put forward by animal welfare groups that wanted to eliminate the use of what they considered to be inhumane traps.
Massachusetts is one of a handful of states that has banned certain traps. Dave Waddles is the fur bearer biologist down there for Mass Wildlife. He's kind of the Massachusetts version of Pat Tate. After the referendum passed, the beaver population tripled. Three times the beaver, which, if you're a wildlife advocate, you probably see as a win. But three times the beaver means three times the beaver mischief.
And as a result, the conflict with people and the complaints we received essentially skyrocketed. So in 2001, the state legislature looked at this again and amended the laws to pass a new law. And essentially this time, they now develop an emergency permitting process.
Emergency permits for trapping. Now, though, those permits are given out by towns instead of the state. From Dave's perspective, this has all sorts of downsides. Nobody has any idea how much trapping happens in Massachusetts anymore. Beaver can be trapped in the spring, so you might kill mothers and leave young kits to be abandoned. And what happens to beavers that are killed under a nuisance permit?
Previously, the harvest that was done during our regulated trapping season, those animals were used by trappers, the pelts were used, other portions of the animal were used, and it was a valuable resource for them. The beaver that are now taken during these emergency permits, quite often they're just trapped and then thrown into a landfill and not used at all.
It strikes me that this comes down to a question of how should beavers be controlled? Should we kill them, skin them and eat them and limit them that way? Or should we put in sneaky arrangements of pipes and fences, thereby limiting how much they can expand their habitat, and then let natural forces, starvation, predation, and disease, do the rest? Because let's be real here, we're not about to let them expand back into all the places where they were living before the Europeans arrived. Think about it. If a beaver starts to seriously flood your property, your basement, if that flooding could cost you thousands and thousands of dollars, what would you do?
Well, it's, you know, I always thought I was kind of on the other side when I was doing my midwifery. You know, I'm a hippie girl.
This is Carol Leonard again. You remember Carol, right? Wanted to build the dream house in Maine, then quickly realized a family of beaver had also set their sights on the property. Thought she was the first woman to ever touch me.
For 7 years, I said, you can't kill them. We have to outwit them. That's back when I thought that you could actually outwit a beaver, but you can't. I mean, it's impossible. But I, you know, in my naivete, I said, well, we'll try these beaver deceivers and beaver bafflers and all these doohickers.
The beavers were flooding a spot that was getting dangerously close to where they wanted to build their septic system. And for years, Carol tried and failed to make these beaver devices work. First, she tried a beaver deceiver.
Then we tried a beaver baffler, which I think is a PVC pipe, and you drill holes in it. That's another one that's supposed to, beavers aren't supposed to be able to figure out how to stop the flow. But the last one that we made, the beavers actually stole and hid somewhere, and we can't even find it.
To give credit to his side of the argument, Skip Lyle would say that Carol was just not doing it right. But regardless, eventually, Carol threw up her hands.
So it did get to a point where I finally said, all right, I'm going to learn how to trap them, and we're going to eat them. And my husband thought that I was fooling, but I did. I apprenticed with a trapper in New Hampshire, and I've been eating beaver ever since. It is a whole other different, you know, it's a whole different culture. But, you know, when you start thinking about hunting, we are meat eaters. We're, you know, we are hunter-gatherers. It's part of our who we are. And so to be able to turn a blind eye to that is just a blind eye. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it just those people that are the animal rights activists, well, that's great. I think that the better place for them to be protesting would be the slaughter yards in Chicago. You know, those are just horrible. I think the traditions of hunting and trapping in New England are good, healthy traditions. And I just don't, I can't talk against hunters. I can't. I'm a meat eater.
Carol says over the years, she's trapped around 30 beaver from her property. There's still many of them left, a little downstream from the house lot. But in 2015, they were able to start building that dream home. And now they've finished. That pond that was threatening her septic system is no longer getting any bigger.
The word is out, it's a really dangerous place for beavers to be. So
they've told their friends.
Yeah, they have. They haven't been back.
Beavers and people. We like to live in the same places. And if you ever find that a family of them are eyeing the same spot as you, well, good luck. Before we move on to the next story, I just want to thank Beaver Pros, Ben Goldfarb, and Peter Buescher for helping me to sort this story out. It's complicated stuff, and their insights were invaluable. And if you want to see some beautiful beaver-themed photos, visit our website, outsideinradio.org. While you're there, you can see a time lapse of a beaver pipe being installed. It's pretty neat. From NHPR, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. And we're starting this next story off with a moment from this past winter when I found myself in a car heading to the White Mountains with two of my coworkers, Outside In producer Jimmy Gutierrez.
All right, so my goal for the day is to go down a black diamond.
And Outside In executive producer, Maureen McMurray.
And what do they call it? It's like po or something? Fresh po?
Pow.
Pow, okay.
Powder. Narpow.
What's narpow?
Because it's gnarly.
Oh.
Narpow.
Is gnarly, like, good?
And if you couldn't tell by the hip lingo, we're headed to the White Mountains to ski, a fairly standard thing to do during a New Hampshire winter. But this trip was a little different for two reasons. One, my coworkers Maureen and Jimmy had never been skiing. And two, they had charged me with the task of convincing them that skiing is not only fun, but accessible. And Maureen is with me here in the studio.
Hello.
So how do we get on this? Where did this start?
It was my question. I had the question. I think I was just passing by one day and I was like, Sam, when did skiing get fancy?
Right. With the underlying assumption there that skiing is fancy now.
Yeah. Well, it always seemed fancy to me. I've never been skiing.
Yeah. So you never skied as a kid?
No. I grew up in Massachusetts near a ski mountain. Never skied, though. And I guess just because I was, you know, youngest of four kids, grew up in like a mill town. My parents didn't have money. And it just, I always thought it was for fancy kids, for like private school kids.
Hmm. Well, so I went to public school, and every year all through the month of February, there was like a program where everyone at school would go skiing every Friday, and we'd get like cheap tickets and you'd get cheap rentals. And I bought my first snowboard with like babysitting money, and that's how I got into it. And am I fancy? I don't think I'm fancy.
I don't think you're fancy, although you are wearing an Eddie Bauer vest right now. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, not only me too. I mean, Jimmy had never skied, and you know, I realize he's not even here, so let me go get him. I'll allow Jimmy to speak for himself. Just a moment. Jimmy.
Oh.
Can you come here for a second?
Yeah. Hey, team. What's up?
So, hey, wait. So, Jimmy, you had never been skiing before?
I had never been skiing before, no.
Wait, why not?
It's not a thing that was a possibility, I guess. Like, growing up in an urban area, there's not much skiing that happens. But Milwaukee is pretty flat, too, so I don't have access to, like, mountains or anything like that.
Did you think it was fancy?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, the pictures, I think when I think of people skiing, I think of, like, either a lot of white people in the Olympics, or I think of Dumb and Dumber. And they're super fancy. That's Aspen, right? That's super fancy. So that's it. That's all I've got. That's my baseline.
And I felt like I had to convince you. Like, you know, skiing isn't necessarily fancy. You can do it for, a reasonable amount of money if you do it the right way.
Yeah, so we threw that challenge out to you. We're like, all right, Sam, prove it to us.
Yeah, and our first stop, Loon Mountain, in the sort of southern White Mountains of New Hampshire, was probably not the right choice.
Oh, look, they're skiing.
Do I have to go down that thing?
Well, I mean, you got to go down one black diamond, right?
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, what's the deal with Loon Mountain? I mean, we drove up there. It seemed like it was kind of fancy.
Yeah, so it was founded in 1966 by former governor of New Hampshire, Sherman Adams, chief of staff to Dwight Eisenhower, and was famously the abominable no man. You know, he said no to everybody so they could never get in a meeting with Eisenhower. And at the beginning, it definitely wasn't fancy. It had 12 trails, 2 chairlifts, 1 bathroom. That's basically all it was. But over the years, I mean, it's grown to be probably the biggest resort in New Hampshire. So yeah, we went to the fanciest place in the state.
So what do you see?
Okay, the tickets for an adult for the day are $85.
So it costs $85. So if a family of 4 wanted to come up here, we'd be way plus $200.
Well, with a group lesson, right?
Group lesson,
lift ticket, and rental equipment. So that's, Jimmy, so there's your all-in number. $200 for a lesson, rental, and ticket.
Okay, so Maureen, first impressions?
When we went into the rental shop, it was like all this weird equipment. Felt totally out of place. And it seemed like people were speaking a different language about stuff I didn't know about.
Do me a favor and just sign in over here.
Yeah.
Skier type?
You got a little description right here. That's what skier type is.
Skier type 2.
What's that?
No, I'm skier type 3.
An aggressive skier?
An aggressive skier. Blue and black trails. Preferred ski length. 200.
I need signatures from all of you, please.
What are we agreeing to?
You can read the whole thing if you want to. It probably says that whole skiing is a dangerous sport thing.
Well, you are set to tear up the mountain. Have a lot of fun.
Yeah, no problem.
All right, y'all. Going skiing. Oh, hey.
Hey, how are you?
How are you?
Great.
This is their first time skiing.
Your first time skiing?
Their first time skiing.
Oh, okay.
Where are you guys from? Argentina, Chile?
Argentina, Chile. Yeah.
Muy bien.
Muy bien. You know a little Spanish.
So any words of advice for these two?
New advice? Don't fall.
Don't fall.
Take it one turn at a time.
This is the first part. Don't have fear.
Don't have fear.
All right. Just pull, push, balance. That's it.
Yeah.
Ready?
I'm ready. Easy to say. Hard to do.
So, Maureen, were you scared?
Oh, wait, they have a toe.
Let's just say I was happy that we were starting on the bunny hill.
You just walk right onto it like an escalator.
Oh my God, it's going so fast.
Hey! Okay, so the typical way that people teach you how to ski is you start, and the first time down,
oh my God,
you're snow plowing the whole time, and you just do little snow plow turns.
Yeah.
And you turn by just like putting more pressure on one leg or more pressure on the other leg. But it's all very intuitive. You'll figure it out just naturally.
Okay, Sam, can we just stop right there?
Yeah.
I have to admit, you are not the best ski instructor. I quickly realized when we got to the top of the bunny hill.
I'm sorry. There you go.
Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
Pizza. Push your heels out.
I realized that your instructions were kind of vague.
Oh my God, wait, I don't know how to slow down.
I realized after this that I have never actually taken a lesson So I didn't even have a concept of how I was supposed to teach.
Well, it's like if you throw someone into a deep end and you're like, oh, it's just intuitive.
Oh my God.
Yeah, you'll figure it out.
Yeah, just, you know, use your arms, feel the balance.
It works for Jimmy.
Where's Jimmy? Oh my God, Jimmy's a natural.
There's a reason why people should learn when they're young, because you don't have that fear.
Oh, Jimmy's going off a jump.
Jimmy apparently is still a child at heart. He's like Tom Hanks and Big or something.
Did you find some narpow over there?
I got some narpow. It's in my butt crack right now.
Jimmy was ridiculous.
Totally out of control.
And I felt like, the ugly stepchild or something.
Fish out of water.
Fish out of water, yeah. Just felt like an adult.
Bigger, 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 bigger. Push in.
There you go, there you go, there you go.
Oh my God, wait. I'm too slow.
Yeah, I just couldn't seem to get it right. It's like the better you guys did, the more I seemed to fumble.
Oh my God. I don't like this. Oh my God, this sucks. This. I hate it. I hate it so much.
Woo! Skiing so fancy.
Even though I'm laughing, I was genuinely part angry and part humiliated.
The thing that was interesting is how disheartening it was for you. I mean, and I think that's the big difference between kids and adults, because kids, there's a lot of things that are new for them, and they're kind of used to failing constantly. And so I wasn't prepared for how hard you were going to take it. I will say that.
My ego definitely took a hit, which, I mean, for the record, in retrospect, is good. But at the moment, it was, it felt awful. Real bad.
All right, so how you guys feeling? How are you feeling about your experience here?
I mean, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And, Mo, how are you feeling?
I wouldn't say it was fun. I feel like I have to do it again. And I don't know why I feel compelled to do it again, but I found it to be incredibly frustrating.
So do you think you would do this if it weren't for having a radio story that you're working on?
No. I'll take it a step further.
No.
I don't think I'll ever do this again.
No, Jimmy, you're a natural. That's such a shame.
Okay, let's think about this. How much time do we spend skiing? And how much time do we spend getting ready, paying for everything, moving around? It's a lot longer. I'd pass.
But you're so good at it. Huh.
Wait, why? Just too much rigmarole.
Too much rigmarole. I'm sorry, I have a cookie in my mouth. This is my apres-ski.
Apres-ski.
Apres-ski. There's too much rigmarole, whatever that means. And, I mean, if it's, like, price-wise, like, value-wise, would I ever do it again? I don't think I would.
But, I don't know. I'm still curious to go to a place that maybe isn't as high maintenance, that's cheaper, and that's closer to where we live.
I mean, it's a possibility.
All right. So I failed with Loon, but little did you guys know, I had another trick up my sleeve.
So many surprises.
Outside In will be right back. Hey, I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this is Outside In. Before the break, I brought two of my coworkers who had never been skiing up to Loon Mountain in an attempt to show them that it can be fun. To recap, Jimmy took to it like a fish to water. Maureen, not so much.
I hate it. I hate it so much.
And now it's time to show you guys that skiing can also be affordable. You guys ready for skiing round two?
Round two. I'm ready. I had a few days to recover, and I'm ready to hit the slopes again.
Jimmy? Yeah, it should be fun.
Are we going somewhere different this time, please?
We're going to a place called Veterans Memorial Recreation Area, which, if it sounds down home,
it does.
Yeah. It's a little ski hill in the town of Franklin, New Hampshire, which is an old struggling mill town. It was founded by like a local doctor who had a big family, and it was getting really expensive to bring all his kids up to go skiing at, you know, Waterville, one of the other ski areas in New Hampshire. And so instead, they just found a little slope in town, and there's just like there's a rope tow and a T-bar. And
What's a T-bar? I think I know what a rope tow is. You had said it's like just a rope on the side of a hill that people just grab onto and it yanks you up.
Yeah.
What's a T-bar?
A T-bar is, it's like a chairlift, except instead of like a cable with a chair hanging off it, it's just a cable with a handle hanging off the bottom of it. And you put them behind your knees and it just sort of pulls you up the hill. You kind of ski uphill and then ski down. And it's all volunteers who run it. You know, they pay the lift operators, but only because the state requires them to. And it's just like a way for people to get on snow for not much money.
Is this like a carnival situation? Like when growing up, my mom, if we went by one, she was like, if it's set up in a parking lot, we were not allowed to go on any of the rides. Is this a similar situation?
Is it safe? Is that the question?
Are there carnies there? Yes. Is it safe? Is it safe?
I don't want to characterize the people there before I meet them.
I gotta say, the carny idea has really got me excited. Okay, I am in to skiing now. I'm sold.
Talk to Maureen and Jimmy maybe somewhere in between 5 and 10 minutes ago, and they said they're 3 minutes away and they're not here yet. I think they're calling me. Hey, I just put you on speakerphone.
Okay, yeah, we turned around. I don't know.
The day we drove there, you know, it was snowing.
It was one of the first huge snowstorms in New Hampshire,
which is great for skiing, terrible for driving. What did you think when you pulled in? When you got to the place, what did, like, your impression?
When we pulled up to the place, it was, you know, definitely off of a pretty rural road. Pulled in, small parking lot, and there was just this, like, was it a log? In my mind, I remember it as a log cabin. I don't think it was.
It wasn't.
And then I could see that thing that you had described, the T-bar. I could see that in the distance. In the parking lot, there were two cars parked side by side. One had a Bernie sticker and one had a Trump sticker. So I felt like it really embodied the, like, you know,
New Hampshire.
Yeah, like New Hampshire purple. I was like, okay, I can get down with this. And then we walked inside to the lodge.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm well.
And your heart grew three sizes.
It really was. I did feel like the Grinch. I just walked in and it was like, and then we met Kathy.
Oh, Kathy.
Can you tell me your name on tape?
Oh, sure. Kathy Fuller.
And what's it say on your business card? Kathy Fuller, you know, matriarch of Franklin Memorial.
I grew up here at Franklin. Actually, I am still the treasurer of the Franklin Outing Club. I make sure their bills are paid.
So this is Maureen and Jimmy.
Okay.
So you
They're
have
the novices. This is good. There's a couple of other kids out there, high school kids. You're gonna learn. But the snow's great. They're going slow, and it's good.
Okay.
Yeah. This is exactly what I imagined in my dreams of what a ski lodge is.
I love this. It was started in 1961 by a group of World War II vets. My dad was one of them, one of the local doctors. The land is owned by the city of Franklin, so they gave us the lease. The Franklin Outing Club has a 100-year lease for a dollar, and so we operate it.
$1 for a 100-year lease.
We rely on natural snow. That's an issue. This snow is gold to us right now. I haven't seen this many people here in a few weeks now. Since we opened up on ice.
I think one of the questions that these guys have is sort of like, is skiing a sport that's just for people with money?
Absolutely not. Like, you'll meet the high school kids out here. Literally, the French teacher bought their $20 ticket for the day. Their ski equipment was free because we gave it out of our donation room. We could find something for you so you don't have to rent the next time, you know?
You are selling me on skiing right now.
Fun. A day like today, because plenty of pow, as my grandson said, it's all about the pow.
The gnar pow.
So you fired up? I'm excited. I am. My mood's done a 180, for sure.
Oh my gosh, Maureen. A hamburger is less than $3 here.
I know. I was looking at après-ski, and I'm getting very excited.
It's like, okay, and this is another question I have, is when did these little ski areas start popping up?
So I heard about this from a guy named Jeremy Davis.
Yep. So I'm Jeremy Davis. I'm the founder of the New England and Northeast Lost Ski Areas Project.
And he goes around finding closed down ski areas all over the Northeast and just documenting like, oh, hey, there used to be a little rope toe in this backyard.
They were a very common type of ski lift in the 1930s and even for several decades thereafter because they were relatively easy to construct. And a lot of people just put them up in their fields. If they were farmers, for instance, during the winter months, they could make some extra money on the side by running a little rope toe. And a lot of community groups built ski areas. A lot of ski clubs built these rope toes. And they really spread like wildfire all across the Northeast and New England in the 1930s and 1940s.
And so how many, and when you say spread like wildfire, I mean, how many are we talking about?
Yeah, so there would have been hundreds and hundreds of rope toes. So if you look back and across the entire length of history and for ski areas across New England, going all the way from the mid-1930s to today, you know, certainly 500 or 600 rope toes would be a good estimate, if not even more than that.
I mean, I'm just trying to imagine, and those are probably concentrated in certain spots. So if you're in a mountainous area of New England, there's probably one really close to you.
Oh, yes. And that's what's really, incredible about the whole thing is that, you know, you look at the sheer volume of these number of places, and they were pretty much everywhere at that time. Some towns even had 5 or 6 of them, a few different places. And I think it's really hard for people to realize how many of these places there were, because right now there's about, if you look at all the different types of ski areas that are open in New England today, everything from privately owned rope toes to major resorts, including some private ski areas mixed in there as well, there's about 110 ski areas that have a lift that are operating in New England right now. So to think that there were 6 times that number, looking at it, that have essentially closed, it's a really huge number. And I've tried to help kind of wrap my head around, you know, how many places there would be and how amazing it would be if all those places were still open.
Jesus, that's incredible.
Right? So if the 30s and the 40s were the golden era of these like inexpensive, accessible mini ski areas, the decline started right after that. And there were a lot of reasons. There was World War II.
You had the draft. You had wartime restrictions on gasoline. You had travel restrictions.
You had the interstate highway system, which made it easier to travel to get to the bigger and the better mountains.
Then you had, you know, increasing competition,
which led to this sort of need to keep up with the Joneses.
And if you can't invest in new lifts, new snowmaking and grooming, especially nowadays, it's very tough for some of these places to continue to operate.
And rising expenses.
The insurance costs can be sometimes more than their entire year's profits.
And let's not forget the rise of the American vacation.
Travel became cheaper. People could afford to travel to Florida, head to Disney World, take a cruise, whatever.
Oh, okay, so that's how skiing got fancy.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, the thing that gets us now is that it keeps getting so warm in the winter.
You know, we have lots of extremes year to year in terms of our climate here in New England. And just a few years ago, we had a tremendously snowy and cold winter. And then last year, we had barely any snow. And then this year, we've had some fits and starts, but it hasn't been all that great, except for a few places. And we've had this long January thaw for the last few weeks.
Yeah, Maureen!
Okay, so how was your ski lesson?
It was amazing.
Look at her go!
Oh, Kathy, she was my ski instructor, and she was everything that I wanted. She's a grandmother, she's patient, she's kind, she's not You
go, Mo.
Bless your heart, Sam. You really tried. She was so patient.
How you feeling?
Good. Yeah. Scared, but
she's
good.
She's doing fine.
Okay, thank you.
I think you would like the rope tow.
Okay.
And everyone should have a kind grandmother teach them to ski.
Okay, I'm gonna go up the rope tow, and I'm gonna meet you guys at the top of that lift.
All right. We'll show you how it's done when we get up there, buddy.
Sounds good.
So I was having an amazing time, and it looked like you and Jimmy were having a blast too.
Yeah, there was really good snow that day.
Oh yeah, this is better. Oh, this is the good stuff.
Look at Sam Evans Brown. Shred the gnar power, bro. Shred it, bro.
Ready for this?
Oh, definitely missing a ski. Definitely missing a ski.
Can we go to the top? Yeah, dude. You wanna?
Heck yeah, man. It's super, Sam, I'm all about this place. It's family, it's not like price gouging capitalism, it's good pow.
When it's good.
When it's good, yeah, exactly, that's the thing. So look, you know, they said what, last year they couldn't?
They didn't open at all.
They didn't open at all.
Yeah. But no, seriously, I mean, like, a place like this without natural snow cannot exist.
Yeah.
It can't. They just don't. Like, and just imagine if they tried to install snowmaking. Like, you know, minimum couple $100,000 onto their budget.
That's crazy.
Maureen McMurray, ladies and gentlemen.
She's going side to side, slowing herself down and everything.
Oh, she's got it, she's got it!
She's getting speed!
I did it!
Oh my god!
That is so good!
I felt like I was going kind of fast.
You were going so fast!
Okay.
She's very fit. You looked good. You looked good.
Okay, I'm done. I'm gonna leave on a high note.
Alright.
So, Sam, can I confess something?
You've known how to ski the whole time.
It was all a ruse. No. Working on this story was the first time that I really felt, I believe that climate change is real, but that I felt it was real.
Really?
Yeah. And you may not even remember this, but it was when we were driving home.
Basically, it's just like air and water.
And we were talking about how expensive snowmaking is, and you were, you know, getting into the price of the machines and blah, 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 and resorts.
The mountains have to invest all this money to just, like, keep up with the Joneses because of climate change.
And you started to say some things about the future of skiing in New Hampshire that I just can't stop thinking about.
Are you, as someone who loves to ski, it's, like, part of who you are you concerned about it around here? So you're like within the next 10 years, do you think we're going to see a difference?
We already see, like, if you're skiing every day, you've already seen a difference. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I've got this thought of like, what will it be like to be someone who writes things after there's, like, no more snow in the place that I live anymore? And, like, It feels like I'm like preparing to write a eulogy. But yeah, no, I don't know. Like, you study climate enough, and you come to realize how much of a guess everything is. So, like, I don't know what the date is that like I'm gonna give up on skiing. But I don't buy skis anymore. I'm like, why would I buy new skis that I'm not gonna be able to use them? And I mean, 10 years is probably like a reasonable guess.
10 years, reasonable guess, there's no more skiing.
Right here.
That's crazy. I just moved here. God, I was planning on teaching my daughter how to ski. It's super sad. Jesus.
Go skiing. Yeah.
She's got heavy.
Yeah, right.
I want to see a moose so bad. I had a dream last night that I saw a moose.
Okay, ask Sam. Are ticks good for anything?
Things eat them, I guess. Chickens eat them. I don't know. Chickens eat all sorts of stuff.
Outside In is produced by Maureen McMurray, Taylor Quimby, Logan Shannon, Molly Donahue, Jimmy Gutierrez, and me, Sam Evans-Brown. Thanks this week to Kathy Fuller of the Veterans Memorial Recreation Area and Greg Kwasnick of Loon Mountain for letting us goof off on your slopes with microphones for a few hours. You can find pictures and videos of our skiing adventures at outsideinradio.org. You can also find us on social media. We share all sorts of behind-the-scenes Easter eggs on Twitter and Instagram at outsideinradio. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.